Hello, everyone, and welcome to Teach Right, the podcast for first-time instructors, experienced instructors, and anyone else interested in learning how to teach writing. I'm Daniel Anderson, and we're coming to you from the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. We have a number of guests with us today, and I'll let them introduce themselves.
Okay, I'll start. Hi, my name is Faith Rush, and I'm a first year in the English and Comparative Lit program, and I'm studying 19th, 20th century African American literature. And I'm also a teaching fellow as well.
Hi, I'm Holly. I'm also a first year in the Department of English and Comparative Literature, and I have a focus on rhetoric, composition, and literacy.
Hi, my name is Cal Draper, and I am also a first year in the English and Comparative Literature department. I'm studying 17th century literature and Milton in particular.
Hello, everyone. I am Rene. I'm a second year in the graduate program at the English and Lit department, and this is my first year teaching.
Welcome, everyone. This is fantastic. So today we're talking about modeling, something that happens in the classroom. And there is an article that we read in advance of this conversation called Modeling a Writer's Identity, Reading and Imitation in the Writing Classroom by Robert Brooke. So we may turn to that from time to time and think about how modeling takes place in writing classrooms. I thought I'd start with just a quote from the article and see what your response is. It says, imitation as a learning or teaching strategy thus is more concerned with the identity of the writer than the form of the text. When imitation, because the student writer admires the teacher or professional and wants to act. So this idea that imitation is not about texts, but more about people, I found that refreshing. What did you all make of that piece of the article?
Yeah, I guess I'll start. I think I found it refreshing in many ways because if you just think about text as models and you're simply thinking about the text, it depersonalizes it a little bit. Rather than thinking about who's behind the text, and that's when you're working with models, but also modeling the professor, which I think is something that he talks about. I think that one issue that gets tricky is students are not all going to model the same person or want to model the same person. And I think that some students will latch on to a professor and their personality or their style, how they write. And I don't know that, I don't think there's one way that you can make that work necessarily, but I think that it's a helpful start.
I think it is really interesting the way in which they're talking about identity, because it's not an essential kind of identity, but it's a situational idea of identity, something that is produced in the classroom and in interactions with your students. So the identity fits very well with the idea of the rhetorical triangle. I thought so when I was reading the article. It emphasizes the authorial position, and it's an identity that is informational. It's going to be situational. So it's something that's happening not only for the students, but also for the instructor within the class.
Do you think bringing that to the surface in the class as sort of like an item of content that we're going to talk about identity in a rhetorical way has value? I mean, I feel like this article is suggesting that implicitly writers kind of identify with the identity of other people, but making that sort of an explicit lesson in the class, would that have value, or what do you all think of that?
We're up to that right now in my 105 in our social sciences unit. We're looking at literacy narratives. They've written a literacy narrative. They did that at the beginning of the semester, and now we're actually thinking about not just what is this story, but what is this identity that's being constructed and for whom. And I'm especially interested in having them think about that practice of identity construction for a teacher, for an authority figure. So they're still trying to kind of wrap their minds around identity in a broader way. They're still kind of thinking about demographics and things like that, but we're working on coding the narratives right now and really pulling out more about personality, about what is this person showing about themselves and why.
Yeah. And Renee, when you mentioned the rhetorical situation and bringing the identity into play, Would that apply to students and the instructor?
I think so. And I have actually a quote where Brooks is defining what he thinks about identity. He says, in interacting with others, then, one negotiates and is assigned a kind of consistent stance toward the world based on the pattern of one's past and present interactions. This assigned consistent stance is, as far as anyone in this situation can tell, one's identity. So your identity is not something that comes just from yourself, but it's assigned to you and based on the rhetorical exigences mm-hmm. I'm thinking. And that can be very easily translated into genre and into the author position.
And assigned, I'm interested, that verb is jumping out at me in some ways because it feels a little like it has a little less agency than the way we normally think of our identity in some ways, but maybe it's accurate.
I mean, when I had my students write their literacy narratives, I did get the impression of a lot of identities that seemed to feel assigned to them because they were reflecting on previous literacy experiences. They were thinking about teachers that they had had, and they were so impacted by things like the feedback that they received or the kind of reading that they did. And so the identity that they showed in those texts to me felt, it did feel a little assigned by authority figures. Yeah.
Yeah, there's the writer identity, the student identity, the teacher identity. I'm wondering about this, like if identity becomes the focus, first, does that create, I don't know if stereotypes is the exact right word, but kind of expectations. There's this sort of dead poet society model of the teacher who's got to inspire the class and all of that. You know, does it create kind of a lot of pressure to have a teacherly identity then that you bring to this, you know, instructional equation?
Again, I would contest that because I don't think that you come to the class with an identity fully formed. I think that you're going to create an identity based on interactions that you have with your students, based on responses to assignments that you yourself are bringing to the classroom. So it's something that is in construction. And assign made it seems like it's just in one direction, but it's in both. It's in more of a negotiation.
Uh-huh. I like that. I mean, I think philosophically that makes sense. I just feel like there's a lot of stereotypes of like what a teacher should be. Yeah. And so I guess in this negotiation, that's going to be a piece of it. Like, you know, I'm not the teacher that you saw on television or something like that. I'm wondering, and how conscious are people of this, you know, when they're negotiating these different identities?
I'm thinking that as an instructor, I'm not going to try to model intimate aspects of myself, but maybe I'm going to try to model curiosity. So if I'm explaining an assignment, I would make an emphasis maybe in, oh, did you notice this word? Did you notice where it comes from? It might not be directly related to what I want them to do, but it's modeling a kind of behavior that is going to serve them in the future. Mm-hmm. Like, let's know more. Let's find out more information about this. And how do we go about doing that, finding out?
Yeah.
So that's an example.
Yeah. I really like that with the kind of trait-like approach. You know, let's be curious. Let's be open, whatever those sort of characteristics are in some ways. Yeah. So what are some of those that we would aspire toward, I wonder?
I think like with reading or with using models, sometimes I always prepare like maybe one or two paragraphs of my own thoughts after I've read the material. And when I have the students working through the material with their own questions, we sort of can go around as a whole group and talk about our thoughts. And I like to sort of chime in and say, well, this is what I think. And but what I think is not necessarily what it has, you know, has to be the answer to the questions I give them. But how can we create a conversation about it? How can I express my identity by talking about my answer to the question and hear about your identity from what you've said about reading this text? You know, if it's an essay or something, getting their thoughts on how did I feel about this and how does this play into my opinion and what I could write about? And then giving them my opinions and saying, well, here's what I think, and, you know, kind of shooting back and forth a little bit.
Yeah. That's nice. I think there might be some concern among rhetoric and composition scholars that when you evoke identity, you move into a kind of psychological space a little bit. And the aim here is professional activity aimed at drafting documents and learning to communicate. So, Faith, what do you think about that? I mean, are we in the business of psychology management, or is that maybe a misreading of what's on the table here?
Yeah, I think in academia, there's that fine line, especially when you're dealing with like first year students of like you want, like they're very impressionable at that stage. So I think there is like some psychology involved, but I think it's more about the behaviors that we're trying to model for them to survive in these different spaces, like professional space, specifically like academia. But I think it's more so about the behaviors that we can teach them. So I don't know if that like counts or constitutes as like a psychological aspect. I don't necessarily see it in that context or way. I could see how it could be interpreted that way. But I think for me, it's more about teaching them the tool. It's I guess having a toolbox, like they have a toolbox. You're like, okay, here's these tools that you need for this genre. Here are the tools you need for this genre. So maybe it's not necessarily behavior, because that could be more of a psychological term, but giving them the necessary tools that they need to be able to flow in between these different modes of writing.
Yeah, I like that sense of agility that you're kind of imagining for students. And if I guess you're modeling that or helping them come to that kind of a thing. And maybe this is where you were with this, Renee, too. Characteristics, maybe they overlap with psychology a little bit. If you're a curious person, maybe that's a somewhat psychological aspect of your identity, but not like you need to find yourself, sort of let's light some candles and, you know, that. But I mean, people will go there when you talk about this class is not for you to learn to write professionally, but to find an identity for yourself.
I think that's why it's so important, the distinction that he establishes when he goes on to define what identity means for him. And as we were talking about what the goal of a writing class should be, I'm thinking of another thing that he says, and it's just a sentence, but it's an opposition that I think might be productive. He says, the growth of students as writers is not the same as the improvement of texts. So I want to know how we feel about that.
I don't know about us collectively, but I feel like I'm in the business of psychology. I think that a lot of qualities about self-image come through in writing and writing practices. And I think it's helpful to sort of change your stance from student to student depending upon what kind of stance toward writing you see. So students who are used to doing really well are a little more resistant to something like revision, right? But a student who really struggled with writing and reading as a child is maybe less uncomfortable with the idea that they need to grow and they need to revise. So I think I'm a psychologist.
Yeah, I would agree. I think I do lean that way, because I think how they view writing will determine how they succeed or don't in a course like this. And so I think you, in a sense, you do have to model or showcase different ways of writing so that they understand, like, okay, the way you approach writing isn't necessarily wrong just because it's not in this specific context. So I would say, like, I do think behavior is important, because that will determine how they process and internalize, like, the assignments.
I like where you all are going with this, is instead of eschewing the idea that we are in the psychology business, just accept it, but figure out what that means in the context in which we're working in some ways. And I don't know exactly what to make of the we're in the business to help students grow as writers rather than produce text. But I do know that I like that. I think there's a lot of value, and we probably will benefit from pursuing that kind of approach in some ways.
like if we think of the time frame in which our classes take place, is it believable that our aim is for them, for the students to create a perfect text, or that they leave the class with some skills that will maybe allow them to create a better text in the future?
Yeah, that's fascinating to me in some ways, because I don't think it devalues the texts or the writing, but it puts them in a different role. It makes them as kind of facilitating instruments for something else that's coming out of this writing class. Yeah. And yeah, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say on Renee's point, I think not producing a perfect text, you know, producing a perfect text is not the goal. And I think that, you know, when they look at these assignments, and if you do something like a portfolio or something, they can reflect back and think, okay, where was I at the beginning of the semester? And how has this shaped me as the kind of writer I want to be? What worked, what didn't work? And that may be different for each student, but that gets into, you know, the various identities that students are going to have. And we teach them some of that through how we model. But yeah, each student will have their own kind of story over the semester of where did I start and how did I end up here? And how can I take that further into classes in the future?
Yeah. And that's something you would make explicit? That be the part of the focus is how are you growing as a writer or as a thinker?
I think, and I don't do this now, but I think giving them room for even personal reflection after they've written assignments, maybe just journaling or coming up with, you know, a few paragraphs of what did I learn through this assignment, what worked for me and what didn't work, and then just charting that throughout the semester and saying, okay, I've arrived at this point. How did I get here? What am I taking away?
Yeah. And a devil's advocate question, then why grade the written products at all? If the aim or the outcome is this more personal change,
yeah,
then how do we measure that? And, you know, the documents become much less relevant in some ways.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think providing grades, I do have a grading instead of a portfolio. That was just an idea. But I think that, yeah, providing grades can be helpful in giving review, you know, giving comments after you read their feeders or read their assignments is helpful. But I think when they, you know, they read those comments, I sort of say, okay, how can I fix this and do it in a way that works for me?
Yeah. I'm thinking that the documents are more important now, actually, because they're co-equal in this kind of partnership with the material world in some ways. Like there's no way I'm going to grow or learn unless there's something that I'm pushing against or something I'm wrestling with in some way. So the document is actually pretty important.
I would say that even more than the document, I'm still leaning the other way a little bit. It's the structure of a scaffolding assignments. I think that's what's really important, because that gives you a way to assess progress and give students opportunity to improve, as I said before, not towards the final document, but towards building up those skills that are going to be useful for them in other places. So I think grading is important insofar it gives you an opportunity to assess how students are acting on your feedback, which I think is very important.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I could totally see that. If it's just a stamp on a document, then less important. But if it's part of this process of change and guidance, then that feedback becomes really important. And those artifacts are participating in it in an interesting way. Yeah.
I'm doing portfolio grading, and a large component of the portfolio grade is revision and deep revision in particular. So mine do not get quality grades from me. They just get feedback. It is mystifying to them, but I do not want them to have the impression that an A means that you are finished with a paper or that you've totally explored an idea.
Yeah, I do the same. I'm in portfolio grading as well. I do give them like marker grades that kind of just show them like, hey, this is where you're at if I were to have graded this. And so it does kind of put them in this anxiety-inducing state. And they're like, I don't know. Like, they just want to, like, fix it to get it right. But I have to remind them, I'm like, this is a process. Like, I think even modeling, like, what revision looks like and what, like, okay, here's the feedback, but let me model, like, what I want you to do with this feedback and why it's important, I think can help them kind of grasp that overarching idea of, like, okay, this is a process and, like, I'm working towards not necessarily a final product, but I'm working towards something that is better than what I did before. And like you said, Renee, just like building on those skills, like it's not necessarily about having a final product because you'll never have one.
I showed mine a truly chilling sight the other day. I was looking for a paper in my files and I found like 10 different iterations of this article I had worked on just stacked on top of each other, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And I showed them that. And I said, I really want you to see that this kind of constant deep revision is not an indication that you are a bad writer. It's an indication that you care, that you're engaged. So I did model that, I feel, by sort of showing them there is an extreme to this and it's fine.
I really like what I'm hearing because to me, it sounds like there is an argument for the effectiveness of this approach of I'm going to show you what it's like to be a writer and it's messy and I want to guide you on that. And I'm going to even show you how to give feedback. So in some ways, everything you do, you're modeling, I think, and probably not just in a writing class, but in, as you said, in whatever situation you are, you're kind of modeling behavior. So it's effective. I think it is probably really effective. One question some people might have or challenge, and the author actually takes this up, is if it is effective, in which ways might that be a problem then? And I think, you know, the negative term you some people might substitute for modeling would be something like indoctrination or, you know, shaping. When does shaping become a challenge, or is that something we need to worry about as well?
I don't feel like it's indoctrination. I guess an example would be like in the creative writing workshop space, because I have dealt a lot with that. We get a lot of models all the time. Like that's all you're doing. You're looking at models and you're trying to figure out what you want to adopt, what you may want to replicate. And while you could see that as indoctrination, it is also up to the individual to choose whether they want to model that or not. So I think the power dynamic there can sometimes lean too much in the instructor's hand to be like, okay, I'm here, like I'm in this place of authority. You kind of do what I say, like do what I do. But that's not necessarily the approach that we in English 105 are trying to take, I think. And so we're trying to balance that and put it back in their hands. Like, okay, you do have agency to choose, like, do you want to model this or not? And obviously they have to model certain things with like the way that the assignments are laid out, but they have more leniency in how they internalize that and how they approach that.
Yeah, I think that makes sense. I mean, the article itself pointed out 3 responses to this kind of procedure, and one of them was rejection, I think. Another one was embracing or accepting this, and I can't remember what the third one was, but some kind of accommodation in the middle. So the point was students aren't just like an empty vessel that is going to take you, you know, have this modeling just shape them in some ways.
Yeah, and I can't remember the name of the book that the author assigned to the class, but there was a certain book that he had them read throughout the semester. And as you said, some students latched onto it and said, I feel like my identity resonates with this author's identity and how they write. And that impacted their writing. And then others, you know, didn't feel that way so much. But I think that, yeah, different students are going to pick up, I think, like you said, Faith, are going to pick up things that they think, okay, I want to model this in my writing and who I am as a student and as a thinker. While other students aren't going to pick that up. And I think that's okay to have some sort of variety where students aren't always, not everyone's going to be modeling you.
I think it goes back to the fact that the outcomes of modeling cannot be controlled. They're not something that the instructor can control. Not if we're talking about behaviors and how to be a writer. So there's that element that wouldn't allow it to be an indoctrination scenario. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think so. And that's making me rethink the premise or the starting place from which an instructor operates with this idea that I'm going to model. Like, if I'm hearing you correctly, Renee, you're kind of saying if you start with a, some kind of aim, like, oh, I'm going to model this because it's going to lead to that. That's maybe not the right approach. Like, maybe what we're not doing is this sort of like deliberate didactic kind of, I need to model this so that this happens. Modeling would just happen organically if you are behaving in a way as an instructor in your own way that fits the situation or that meets your kind of aspirations, and then the rest just happens. Is that, or is there room for deliberateness and didactic kind of modeling?
The way I approach the classroom up to this point is I don't go there trying to be prescriptive. I just go there trying to be useful. So that could be a way of framing that. I'm not giving them a model that they're going to have to follow if they want to, get an A. But I'm sharing with them everything that works for me in the genres that we are exploring.
Yeah.
And I am also open to listening and learning from what works for them, because they're also writers.
Yeah. Can we go back to the identity question then about how provisional and context-driven our identities are, as opposed to, I hate to say it, but core aspects of ourself in some ways that we, you know, carry with us in almost any situation, and how much do we need to pay attention to those, or how do those core aspects come back in? Because I'm thinking of you saying something like be useful. You probably, if you're someone who wants to be useful, you're going to be useful across multiple contexts, and it's just a piece of yourself in some ways. So I don't know, for some reason I'm wanting to go back to that.
I had my students read a piece by Bronwyn Williams about literacy narratives, and he talks about these archetypes that all students embody: hero, rebel, victim. It's one of those. And I don't necessarily believe that all students embody one of those archetypes, but I had them read it and I had them think about whether or not they did in their own writing. And one of my students said, I don't think I really presented any kind of particular identity. I was just concerned about getting a good grade. And I responded and I said, but isn't that a presentation of your identity? That you are shaping this so that a teacher, an authority figure, approves of it? And the student usually doesn't respond to my marginal comments. And she replied and she said, whoa, .. So they, you know, they seem to think that there's a neutrality in this space that I don't actually think is there. And once you show them that, they're like, their minds are blown.
Nice. Yeah, that sounds like a nice little moment from the class. Let's see if we can maybe close out by looking at this modeling heuristically for instructors then. I still have this somewhat sense of these being organic elements, and it might short circuit the process if you try to be too deliberate, like, oh, today I'm going to model how to be a generous reader. But I could also see how you could maybe in a sort of strategic way say, I need to model a way of reading for these students. They're used to just knocking each other down. I want to show them something different and be kind of deliberate. And then these other aspects like, well, I don't want to personalize things. I want to be a professional. So don't personalize, just treat things professionally. If you have these, I don't know, handles of identity that you could grab a hold of, how can those become drivers of instruction, or, you know, how can they help you move through the 15 weeks of a semester in some ways?
I don't know if this is getting at the question, so you can always tell me if it's not. But I, in terms of revision, I'm like a big proponent for revision. I'm like, revise all day, every day. Like, you need to revise. It's important. And sometimes I think they don't necessarily understand like the complexities of revision and how much of like a real process it is versus just like, oh, let me just go fix these certain things. Like, you do have to reinteract with the text, which can be difficult and I think challenging. So I sometimes will model that for them where we will, like, normally I'll highlight. So I highlight through, I'll highlight, like, you know, basic revisions, like larger revisions that need to be done. I'll highlight for, like, grammar. There's different, like, aspects, and I'll highlight them in different colors. And so I've done in previous classes where I've actually modeled that for them. I'm like, okay, here's, like, my essay. So, like, I'm like, you can rip me to shreds. And I'll have us, like, go through the essay and be like, okay, like, what's working here? Like, let's highlight, you know, everything that I'm saying. Let's highlight, you know, the secondary sources. Like, is there an imbalance here in some paragraphs? And I think doing it in that way, it helps them see, like, oh, wait, like, actually, revision is important. Like, these are the things that I should be paying attention to, because those are also things like I'm looking for as I grade. So it's also like kind of doing two things at once there. But I guess that's a way in which I've used my identity to be able to model something for them that could be useful for them in the future.
Yeah. I think one thing for me that actually came up last class is we were talking about the writing context, and we were talking about the writing process, but talking about the writing context and what works for students, what types of environments do they like to write in, and do they listen to music, do they not listen to music, you know, those types of questions, and sort of asking what their greatest fears are when it comes to writing, what obstacles do they come up against. And I sort of talked about my struggle with perfectionism in writing, and how that was, I guess, key to my identity as a writer, and how it's very difficult to put down that first paragraph. And we just sort of brainstormed together, how do different people go about that? You know, what's your process? Here's what I do. And maybe giving them a few ideas that don't just come from me, but other students, choices, options, like, how could I do this differently? When I hit that block, that writer's block, you know, so to speak. But
yeah, I like that you're opening the possibility for peer-to-peer modeling to take place in many ways too. I think that's a really cool strategy that we can try to implement. And then what I'm hearing a little bit is it's maybe not a side effect, maybe just an outcome of teaching, is that your own identity as a writer actually gets refined a little bit, or you get to work on that, thinking through some of your own. Yeah. So that's a really nice way of thinking about it. Like, what am I trying to do is just focus on write, you know, what does a writer do? And I'm a writer as well. So you can teach that way. Sounds like a pretty interesting way of going about it. Well, the last thing I guess I'll ask is, you know, the way that English 105 is constructed, I don't know that we're giving as much advice in this vein as we might. I think when we talk about modeling in English 105, we talk about how to lead a discussion, which seems valuable. But we talk about models in the way that this article opposes. We bring up a model and we put it on the projector and we say, this is the kind of document you're trying to produce. We're modeling texts a lot of times. That's not exactly accurate, because then we talk, you know, we're modeling, putting it up there and talking about it as much as anything. But, you know, what advice would you give to 105 instructors, or what revisions might you make to the instruction that teachers get based on this conversation that we've just had?
I think modeling peer review is really useful, because I think it's easy to just say, well, it's peer review, so I'm just going to turn them loose. But that can be not always generative, not always productive. And so I have mine workshop as a group, and I sit in there with them as a peer, and I mostly hold back. I really kind of feel like I function to push the conversation along when it starts to lull. But it's very important to me that they understand, and that I'm explicit about the fact that there is intentionality in the way that I give feedback. There is a structure. I'm thinking about how it's going to impact them emotionally, and I'm phrasing it in particular ways. And there's a whole kind of pedagogy here that I want them to be able to learn and adopt and give to their peers.
Yeah, I like that. And my brain always goes into scenarios. I'm thinking of a cool activity in a class where you bring a piece of your writing in and then bring in a peer or somebody and like, let me get the treatment here and show how tough it can be, or, you know, all of that. It could be kind of a cool way of breaking the frame.
I'm really excited to show them my first peer review that I got from submitting an article. I'm really excited to show the badge through how I responded to that.
Yeah, we all have some rejection letters and things we could produce probably show how hard this work is. Yeah. Well, this has been fantastic. I really enjoyed it because I'm leaving with more ideas than we started with, I think, and, you know, thoughts about how to do all of this. And at first I was thinking this piece is from 1988 and it has these kind of veins of expressivism in there, and, you know, it might, I don't know, but I'm pretty much sold. I think the idea that, you know, you are modeling how to be in the world in a classroom as much as, you know, just how to produce documents, that seems compelling to me. Yeah. Final thoughts?
I think we are psychologists.
Yeah, that we need more training on that too. Yeah. Well, thank you, Faith, Holly, Cal, and Renee. This has been a wonderful conversation. And anyone listening, please tune in next time for another episode of Teach Right.